So what do we all make of the new Mac Mini announcement and the Mac Studio last week? Anyone buying one?
Who cares about Mac things, honestly?
Oh my God, this guy. He's so freaking Linux-pilled.
So Apple have announced a new Mac Mini with an M5 Pro chip in it, an M6 chips, the first one in their lineup to get the M6. They also refreshed the Mac Studio as well. And what's interesting about that one is not only do you have the M5 Max, you've also now got the M5 Ultra, if your pocketbook extends that far. If you put the minerals inside this Mac Studio, you can very easily send it north of 10,000 US.
I was saying, isn't this one that has like 32 terabytes of RAM or something absolutely stupid?
Not quite that stupid, but it's pretty stupid. Yeah. So like if I'm on the configurator right now, 36 core CPU, 80 core GPU adds $1,300 to the base price of $5,500. So I'm already at 68. Then I add 256 gigs of RAM. That adds $4,000. That's the most right now. It says 512 memory coming for the M5 Ultra in late October. So God only knows what that's going to cost. But I'm now at $10,800 and I haven't even added storage yet. I can add up to 16 terabytes for another $7,500. Which takes my meager Mac Studio to $18,299 before tax.
I was going to say who's going to buy this, but we all know who's going to buy it. So, wow. Good on you. Good on you, Apple. You know, go John Ternus. You know, go make some hardware.
Well, it does say shipping lead time 12 to 14 weeks, in fairness. Nobody's going to... I say nobody. Some research lab somewhere is going to buy that one. But the one I'm actually interested in is the new Mac Mini.
That seems to be the one that's getting most of the attention that I'm seeing online, too.
They're just so cute. So cool. Aren't they? I mean, so you do end up in this weird crossover at sort of $1,500 to $2,000-ish when you've put a few little things, like once you upgrade one or two things on this Mini, like you put 10 gig Ethernet in there or you put a little bit more memory in there, you end up in this uncanny valley where it's basically the same price to get the entry-level Mac Studio and you get the better cooling and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I kind of want one for this desk because I've got an M3 Max that 14-inch in front of me and it's right now sat at 75 Celsius as we record. So it's when it's doing video conferencing, it just likes to get a little bit toasty. So I don't know. The Mac Mini looks quite appealing to me.
Apple's so good at pricing things so that, like, really, it's just a tiny bit more to get the better thing. Like, they do it so perfectly. It's textbook.
It's almost as good as airlines. Like, if I want to fly from Raleigh to London, it's like $1,500 round trip. Yeah. And I think, oh, I could do better than that. I can book a single ticket from JFK for $800, $900, whatever it is. And then I look at how much a single flight from here to New York would be, and it's $300 or $400, and I'm like, I may as well just fly direct.
They have done market research out the wazoo.
Yes, indeed they have.
I think we should probably talk a bit about something that I don't think we've actually talked about on this show before, and that's home audio. Alex is a bit of a fan of a good set of speakers. In fact, he can, right there. And for everyone that is watching the video, he's got a set of KEF LS50, but not the Meta version.
No, these are the actual original LS50s from 2015. And I felt zero desire to upgrade them in that whole time because they're just so good.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. The Metas are way better, and you definitely should be buying them. But that's not the point. They're an extremely expensive, well, for most people, set of bookshelves. If you're coming from, you know, the back in the days where you used to buy a Logitech set of speakers, plump them on your desk, hook them to your computer, and you had that killer looking subwoofer that actually wasn't a subwoofer at all because it was just a fake thing at the front and it had a tiny speaker inside. But I digress.
I feel attacked, sir.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. There's been some changes in the audio world. But first, maybe not a home audio thing, but Plex Amp finally got a huge update that I'm perplexed on.
Oh, every time.
Every time, right? A certified dad. So I read these release notes, right? And I'm going through it. I'm like, yes, they've they really have rewritten so much here. And I got to the end and I'm like, wait, what's actually new? And then I promptly joined the beta and got the latest version and looked at it and went, what is new? And so I hope one of you looked through that, and maybe you do more programmy things than I do, but I'm hoping one of you can explain what they actually changed that I would actually care about. And there was a lot of actuallys in those sentences, but what changed? Why do I care? And why did it take so long to get the next update?
Well, actually, PlexAmp is now free for all users. They still have Plex Pass. They still put like things like Sonic Sage, Guest DJ, Headless PlexAmp. That's still behind Plex Pass, Lyrics 2. But it's now free for everybody, which I think is nice.
I wasn't a big Plex user, but I also never really saw... I know people rave about PlexAmp, but it was not really my thing.
So I think for me, like when you're trying to look at replacing the elephant, you know, the juggernaut in the space of Spotify, you need a few things. You need discovery. You need some kind of smarts for the player to be able to link sonically your library together, so like you don't end up with Rammstein next to Debussy, for example. Although I wouldn't mind that, but you know, sometimes you just want a heavy playlist. And so that's what some of these features do. Also, the headless PlexAmp on a Raspberry Pi feature, that's pretty nice. You know, you can just plug that into any set of powered speakers, and it becomes a network streamer. So the thing that it lacks really is just a coherent experience. With Spotify, you've got Spotify Connect. With PlexAmp, you don't even really have the like remote control functionality between different things, which is kind of a pain. But yeah, I'm struggling, Stephen. I'm looking at the release notes, and I don't really see anything terribly new in there, despite all the fanfare.
I was hoping at the very least it would be able to do some sort of auto creation of playlists that make sense. But I was just fiddling with it before the show here, and just like you said, it jump yeah, indeed yes it jumps from one genre to the next. It's not like I wanted to do like a trance sort of playlist. It just decided to go off and do Rammstein trance, some sort of Celtic music that I didn't remember that I had, and I'm just like, well, it's nice, yeah, I haven't heard this stuff in a while, but it's not really something that I would want to listen to. It's just really kind of annoying, right? For me, PlexAmp works really, really well, and it looks nice, but it's missing the features I need to move off of something like Spotify.
As many of you know, I dumped Plex pretty publicly in June, and I haven't felt the need to spin it back up at all. I recently just took a two-week trip to California for Tailscale Up and to, you know, do the Unraid onboarding, and I haven't missed it at all, even whilst traveling. Like, just Tailscale lets me connect back home, and I'm not a paid shill anymore. It just genuinely actually does the thing I need it to do. But what I found myself doing for music was spinning up something called Navidrome. I'm sure you're familiar with Navidrome. But I was missing a few of the discovery, the things I mentioned a moment ago. And so for daily mixes, I've been trialing this thing called Navibeat Mixes that can generate multiple playlists entirely from your library. So to do things like the time of day mix, the discovery, things you've been on heavy rotation, that kind of thing. And we'll link all of this in the show notes, of course, so don't worry. But then the other thing I found I was missing was that kind of like Sonic Sage thing that we were just talking about. Like, I want my EDM like mood. I know what genre I'm in the mood for. And I found this Navidrome plugin called Audio Muse AI, which analyzes the actual audio locally and then analyzes every track in your library and kind of generates, it's pretty good. It's not perfect, but it's certainly better than nothing. Generates this artist radio instant mix kind of vibe based on certain sonic signatures that it picks up in your library. And then the final piece is the kind of history for longer term things like Discover Weekly and that kind of stuff. So I've been using this thing called Listen Brains, which allows me to do, you remember the Last FM scrobbling thing that you could do where you could basically say,
oh yeah,
here's all the music I've listened to today, and it would just automatically upload your subsonic listening history as you went. That's where Listen Brains came in. And then the final piece is something called Explo, E-X-P-L-O, and that's the glue, really, that kind of brings it all together. It reads the Listen Brain recommendations and obtains kind of like the matching tracks from its I'm not even sure how it works, to be honest, but I know it works really, really well behind the scenes. And it ports the stuff into your library and kind of creates more playlists for you to go through. And I've been really enjoying that for the last couple of weeks whilst I've been on the road.
I think we actually need you to make a YouTube video describing all of these features and how to set them up.
Second.
Coming to a YouTube channel near you at some point when I've had a moment for my ass to hit the ground, because we're recording this already 2 days late, so thank you, gents, for bearing with me. But the last 2 weeks for me have just been nuts. Yeah, you probably know why if you're listening to this, but yeah, it's been a busy one, but I will get to a video about it.
So do any of you have a Spotify speaker? Or Sonos? No, it's a Spotify speaker. A Sonos speaker, you can use Spotify on it. Do any of you have a Sonos speaker in your house?
Yes, I have several.
I've always refused to buy into a proprietary audio ecosystem because it's been one of those technologies that I've been like, I shouldn't have to pay a tax for this.
Yes, but hear me out on this one. So I was the same mindset as you originally, because when we moved into this house, I wanted to have audio, and my wife refused to let me put in, you know, we built the house, I could have had conduit everywhere and put in, you know, a whole home audio system, and she says, no wires. I'm like, okay. So I had to go something wireless. So I went with the Denon HEO system, which, again, little proprietary, but open-ish enough, you know, more open than Sonos. It was absolutely garbage. I could never get my phone to reliably connect to it. It just, I never used them. I got tired of it, and so I got Sonos speakers in here, and they work out of the box locally with Home Assistant. I've never had an issue with them on Home Assistant. Music Assistant works with it, again, locally, not a problem. I know there was the whole app snafu a year or so ago. I rarely use the app, so I didn't even really ever notice. So yes, I know you're paying a tax, and I think we're going to talk in a minute about some other solutions that you can use other than the Sonos that I'm curious about. But for being, you know, proprietary and all that, they're still fairly open with the local API, so I haven't really felt that I've been locked into these things.
I'm also going to be a Sonos apologist real quick. So I used to work at Circuit City, and I had all of the... I had a really nice Onkyo amp at the time. I went with the tower speakers, the whole setup, right? You get the discount. So I bought all the toys. But, and that was great for a long while. Not so great for the multiple moves between houses that I went through to have to rewire all of this stuff and whatnot. And on one of my final houses in California, we switched over to a projector versus a standard television, and it was so nice to have the Sonos soundbar up front rather than having to run all this cabling and deal with where do I put my receiver at this point, up in front of everything, do I try to put it behind, etc., etc. It was so great to just have a package deal and just have this soundbar that wirelessly connected back to the projector. Bada bing, bada boom. Just a wonderful experience, honestly. So from a, would you call that a convenience perspective, or what would you call that? Just from the perspective of different configurations as you're moving and trying different things, Sonos is pretty kick-ass for that.
So you guys were poo-pooing Sonos. What do you guys use for your whole home audio?
No, this is an awkward conversation. I don't do whole home audio. I just have a two-channel audio system that I use, and we won't get into those things. But I will say that your wireless thing can be very helpful. And even in the high-end audio, that world has really opened up to the idea of less cables. And so, for example, the KEF speakers that Alex has there is a LS50 wireless. And I think they have a couple iterations now. And there's even a floor-standing one that's called an LS60 wireless. Many, many dollars will be spent. But the thing is that they have amplifiers and everything else built into them. I suppose the Sonos do too, except for one sounds like a tin can and one sounds like full audio.
It's always been an issue for me too. It's like the audio quality. Like, I know what really good audio sounds like, and there's no way you'll get it out of something the size of a shoebox. It's just not possible.
The only thing I can say about the Sonos, and I don't even think they make them anymore, but they're the little can size. Yeah,
they make them. That's what I have. I have three of them.
I think they're okay for if you were in like an office setting and you just needed like a couple of speakers here and there that are never turned up past like 25% volume. It's just kind of background sound. I think that's okay. But if you ever want life in your audio, it's just not doing it for me. And in fairness, before someone says, well, have you ever tried doing a stereo pair? I had a set of the, I think they're called the fives or whatever they were called. And I had them set up as a full stereo pair. And I even had the really expensive subwoofer that is pretty embarrassing. And it doesn't hold a candle to even like the LS50s that are behind Alex. They just don't. Now, Alex there has to have a pretty decent amplifier to push those, granted. And so he has a bunch of cables, and I do understand that. But if he had the wireless version of that, I think both of you would find that that's a perfectly fine amount of cables. Like, it has a power cord that goes to one, and technically you can go to the second speaker wirelessly or with, like, an Ethernet cable. But, yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just too experienced with the higher-end, quote-unquote, higher-end audio that things bother me when they sound tinny. That's just it for me.
Well, do you have a suggestion for something that would work for... So you're mentioning, like, there's the wireless option for things like that. I would love to understand if there's a great wireless surround sound option besides Sonos, and I'm just missing something that's way better from a quality perspective.
Funny you should mention that, Adam. So I stumbled across this on Reddit the other day. Apollo Automation just released what they're calling the Cast One, which is basically their version of a Chromecast, but it runs on ESP Home. And it is going to use SendSpin, which is the Open Home Foundation's, you know, version of Snapcast, to, you know, handle all the audio, you know, stuff with the syncing and everything. So you buy these, they're $30. It's got a DAC. It's got, you know, 3.5 millimeter jack coming out of it. You can plug it into basically any existing speakers you have in your house, and you could have whole home audio. I'm tempted to buy like five of them.
What would you do for the surround sound, like the routing of all of that? You just have to have a receiver still somewhere, correct?
It can power the speakers, I think. I don't know. You guys tell me if I'm crazy on that one, but I think it can power the speakers.
I mean, I don't know how it would handle the codecs, specifically in decoding of surround sound stuff. I think what this is more designed for is, well, just filling a space with sound. It's not really designed for making a helicopter fly over your head or something. I don't think. I could be wrong. Certainly, Chromecast audio was originally designed to just send more than one stream of music to a remote place. Now, what will make or break this for me, and by the way, SendSpin is wonderful. It's part of the whole Home Assistant Nebukasa universe. Mwah, chef's kiss to those guys. Thank you for doing what you're doing. The thing that will make or break this for me is like the user experience. When I use AirPlay, which is admittedly what I do right now, and it kind of stinks because it streams direct from the phone. If there's any kind of interference between the phone and the device, it cuts out and it's really annoying. With this Cast One device, I'm hoping it'll do what the Chromecasts do and get the remote URL into the devices themselves and not have a dependency on my local device having reliable connectivity at all times wherever I am in the house to the network with enough latency that it doesn't buffer or anything like that. So
yeah, it's going to use Music Assistant as the back end. So if you use Music Assistant, it'll basically handle the streaming for you to your speakers.
There you go. And here's to hoping it also plugs into that Navidrome ecosystem I just talked about too. This is the thing with self-hosting.
It does.
Ah, wicked. Okay, great.
If it does, the codecs sold. But yeah, I need the helicopter flying over my head. Still,
I suspect these things are priced at $30 each. I suspect there probably isn't enough overhead for like a Dolby license in there. But I could
probably
be wrong.
Not for Dolby. No, probably not. Adam, you had questions about... You were talking about IPKVMs on our Discord a couple of weeks ago or a couple of days ago with us, you know, talking about which ones we have. But you have questions because I've got one. I know Alex has got one. I'm assuming Steven probably has a couple lying around. So
what's old is new again, my friends. And I was just kind of waxing poetic about the fact that I installed a clean internal boot for Unraid on my little Franken NAS. And it's been so long since I've done that via an IPMI out-of-band management interface. For some reason, I've used them for remote control purposes, all kinds. But I haven't done an install on the Pi KVM via like its internal storage via an ISO. So I was just like, oh my God, I love this. It became novel again, and I was just like, I was just kind of looking around at the landscape of these KVMs, and there are so many inexpensive options these days out there. And one of our coworkers actually had posted that he got a GLINet Comet X, which looks really dang compelling, actually. It has four HDMI and USB ports on it built into the singular unit. They're rack mountable. And he also had a really interesting little, it looked like a Chromecast, actually, with this little puck that was for individual device KVMs. So you could put it on, I guess, a laptop or mobile devices, even is what he was talking about. And so this got me thinking and made me start looking around, like, what are people using these days? Pi KVM was the bee's knees when it first was released and pretty novel at that price point for everything it enabled. But these days, it is a very busy landscape.
A bit of a caveat on the Pi KVM, because if you had just a Raspberry Pi 4 and the camera module, you could do it for maybe $60, $70, something like that. HDMI CSI camera module, not the actual Raspberry Pi camera module, just to be clear. You could do it for cheap. But then the Pi KVM project productized it, and it became this $400 thing that was just not in the spirit, in my mind, of the original kind of like hacker vibes of it. Yeah, fine. It costs money to put a product together. Not complaining about the price. I'm just saying it became a very different proposition at $400 versus less than $100. The Nano KVM came along shortly after at like $30 or $40, which is the size of like a tiny little... It's probably about the size of about four dice put together. In fact, I've got one in the drawer behind me. I don't use it because there was this whole furore about the firmware being open and then closed and then open and then who knows, blah, 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 China, whatever, China bad. So the Nano KVM kind of sat in a drawer, but the one for me that stuck is the Jet KVM. I have like three of these things throughout the house. Really like my Jet KVMs.
I remember when you were possibly, you had that big sale and people were like asking, can we get your Jet KVM? And you're like, over my cold dead body.
I mean, they're basically...
I bought his HDMI switch from his old Pi KVM at said sale. Which is interesting. I've still not even like hooked it up properly, but tell me, why is Jet KVM your go-to? That's what I want to know is like, is it the form factor and the cool little touchscreen, or what is it?
I mean, so I actually have another favorite in this space, and it's the GLINet Comet, not the Comet X you just referred to, but they make another one called the Comet PoE. And that one, for me, they sent me a review for the Tailscale channel, which is now actually sat at my mother-in-law's house in England doing remote duties over there. And it's just powered over PoE, so it's one less power adapter. The GLINet interface is okay. The one I prefer the most, like of all these interfaces, is the Pi KVM, actually, even though it's expensive. Again, I got a cheaper review unit from cloudfree.shop, I think it was, during the self-hosted podcast era, complete with the four-port switcher option that it had. So I actually did a studio, like a rack tour a couple of weeks ago on my YouTube, if you're curious to see what that looks like. But it looks like an octopus got drunk and got in a fight, and there's just a bunch of cables all over the place, and it's not a very pretty thing. Jet KVM, though, it's like the gentleman's IP KVM. It's like, it's the size of an Apple Watch, right? So first of all, it's tiny. It has like a little chin behind it, I suppose. And the interface is good. You have an Ethernet port on the back. It doesn't do PoE. I wish it did, and then it would be perfect. Well, two things to make it perfect. One, PoE. Number two, it takes a micro or a mini HDMI, I forget which, on the back. If they'd just made the device 5 millimeters taller, they could have fit a real HDMI port in there, and I wouldn't need these stupid adapter cables that I have hanging off the back of all of them. Other than that, Jet KVM, perfect device.
Yeah, I have the GLINet Comet. I got one of the first ones when they first came out, and then I actually went out and got the ATX adapter that you can have, so that way I can actually remote power start and all that. That also was a game changer. Again, I haven't used it all that much because I haven't had to, and I'm going to knock on all the wood right now. But the few times I have, it has been absolutely game changer to be able to go in. And yeah, I agree with you, Alex. The interface is, it's fine. It's nothing magical, but it's functional. It works. And I can get into things when things are not responding and I need some kind of interface that is not tied to my internet connection. Well, not tied to the device's internet connection.
It actually occurs to me, I have in a box to my left in the closet one of the Tiny Pilot KVM devices as well, the KVM Tiny Pilot Pro or something.
Yeah.
I've been meaning to review that on the channel because he sent it to me like 6 months ago for a while now. So I'll add that to my list of my backlogs for you, Stephen, and then publish it at some point in the future, maybe.
That would be great, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But, Mr. Stephen, I'm assuming you have to have some kind of... Or do you just rely on KVM built into the boards?
Yeah. So the only reason I have a Pi KVM, and I bought the official one with the nice metal case
here
and whatnot.
Here it comes.
No. Well, I'm not going to poo-poo on your situation. I have one because I don't really like having to go back to the work desk to work on whatever machine that I'm setting up for a client or whatever. So I just hook it to that, and then I can sit at my desk, you know, just use the IP, get into it, and do what I need to. If I'm going to do something in a rack, it's through like an IPMI, so like an iDRAC or something like that off of a Dell server. Honestly, I don't really have desktop things in my racks.
For me, that's besides the obvious application of these devices of leaving them in the rack next to a server. It means you can use consumer-grade hardware now to do what was ostensibly a server-grade hardware job. And with the prices of everything these days, that's a real godsend. But I also now don't have on my workbench... I don't have a keyboard and a mouse and a monitor anymore. I literally just have my laptop wherever I am, and then I can get that same experience in high fidelity across the network. You know, so it's for me, it's replaced having the kind of crash cart monitor and keyboard and mouse just out all the time. And that's my favorite use case for them when I'm like filming or something like that. It's just so good.
I like the continuity of interface too. Like you can... Basically, I really like how this interface works, and I can just expand that to the entirety of my lab versus, I went with Gigabyte on this board, so now I have to deal with this interface.
Do you remember how jank some of that Java crap used to be on some of these?
Oh my God. I never dealt with it, but I've heard horror. I mean, just anything
so bad.
With Java, I'm just like, oh God, why?
It was so
my
bad.
My IX days, man. The nightmare still of the Java interfaces on these things. And the old antiquated versions of Java that you had to have on your machine in order to run these pieces of garbage.
I actually had... So. The reason I have the Comet PoE in England, that server has an IPMI built into it. It's an ASRock rack motherboard. But when I went back at Christmas, it just stopped working. No idea why. The motherboard's fine. The computer boots up fine. But the onboard IPMI is dead, and so I had to find a way to access it remotely that way. So they aren't perfect.
No, they're well, and the onboard IPMI also, one of the benefits is that you get all the sensors that are built into it also, and you, if you're really keen on monitoring your system and getting alerts and stuff, you can tie into those sensor nodes on the built-in IPMI. But typically, I just hate the interfaces on them. Some of the more modern, newer ones are not terrible. And when we were talking about price, you know, whoa, I can go with the consumer level board. Some of the workstation boards that are out there these days are really pretty close on the price. And they come with those out-of-band management and 2.5 gig on the board.
But they also use a lot of power doing it. Like an IPMI can sit there and use 10 or 20 watts, like a built-in iDRAC or whatever, doing nothing. Yep. Before you've even turned the computer on, it's pulling 20 watts. And you're like, what are you doing in there?
Yeah. Totally okay. Correct.
But can you update the firmware on your BIOS and everything else remotely over the internet?
I'm not
with
doing
the
that.
Comet
I'm just
ones?
Not going to do that.
No, I, but I mean, I do. Right? So That's the whole thing, right? And so I do agree that I think that these tools are very handy, especially the way that Alex uses it throughout this house and whatnot. That's super awesome. But if there's a latest patch that came out for a BIOS that I need to deploy across like four servers, I just go into the iDRAC and I just tell it, pull it off of Dell's website. It pulls it through. It does the whole update. It reboots the server, does all the checks and whatnot, and brings it back. It's not just my ability to, you know, have a remote console, right? I have all of the hardware checking in and telling me what's going on. If a fan inside of a server failed, if a NIC died, I can configure all the RAID. Not that I do a ton of RAID, but if you wanted to do RAID, it's all in the same management and everything else. And so it's a bit more robust when you're 100%. when you're doing something like that. I will say that any of the kind of like consumer rack stuff, like the entry level, anytime I've experienced any of their out of band management, it's not the same quality as one of the higher end stuff. Like I just keep choosing iDRAC because I use Dell servers, but it's not the same. And I've always found Supermicro ones, they're kind of frustrating. Mm-hmm. The latest version, not so bad, but I don't know. I don't get along well with them. Yeah.
So I have not, honestly, it's not been a purchasing decision for me for so long as far as my home lab equipment. And I know that you're using this for a different reason, but for your business. And that totally makes sense to me. But one thing that I do, another additional to what you were saying, is that when it can be a great tool when you have the built-in IPMI and it's a robust system for troubleshooting issues as well. Not just from like the alerting, oh, I have a failed fan, but there is some really good information that you can glean from the logs from a good IPMI interface.
Yeah. Temperature stuff, for example, very, very handy. Like, you know, why did that box go down? Well, the OS doesn't know, but you know, if you look at your logs, you can see for some reason, CPU started getting quite hot or something to that effect, right?
Voltage it gives you stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, voltage stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
Now it's time for a quick bit of housekeeping. You can find everything we do over at bitflip.show. We're also on Mastodon at bitflipshow. We'll put links to all of this stuff in the description, of course, down below. This isn't YouTube. It's a podcast. They'll be in the show notes. There you go. That one's better. So if you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email at contact@bitflip.show. We genuinely do read everyone. And if you enjoy the show and fancy supporting what we're doing, you can head over to bitflip.show/support. Finally, a huge thank you to our Terabyte supporters, Maurizio, who sometimes goes by Badneck Mask on our Discord, and Alex Taylor. Those two suggest quite a lot of the topics that we talk about in these episodes, and we've got our own little private members-only chat that we chat with them throughout the weeks as well. So huge thank you to those guys for supporting the show. We really appreciate you helping us keep this thing going. All right, back to it. Who's next up in the show? What are we talking about next?
I was going to want to talk about Sony, because Sony has shot themselves in the foot for like the 80 billionth time when it comes again to ownership. Again. So for those who just don't know, I'll give you a quick recap. They have, you know, taken stuff away from you that you bought through their, you know, digital store, like movies and TV shows. Just a couple of weeks ago, they announced that they were going to stop selling PlayStation 5, you know, physical discs starting at the end of next year. And then I stumbled across this one. California a couple years ago passed a law, AB 2426, which requires if you're buying something online, the company has to say whether you're buying, you know, what are you buying? Are you buying just a license? Are you actually buying something? You have to actually spell it out. And so some customers sued Sony over, you know, alleging a violation of this law, saying that they didn't, you know, adequately describe that, you know, when they, because it said complete purchase, but then it said, you know, be aware you're, you know, what exactly, I wrote this written down. It says that, so here's the text of what it says. It says, by selecting confirm purchase, you agree to complete the purchase in accordance with the PlayStation terms of service before using this content. You further acknowledge that your purchase of this digital product amounts to a license subject to the software product license agreement. Now, I know that probably still sounds legalish, but you can see the words, you are getting a license. So Sony rightfully says, hey, it says very clearly you're buying a license. If they had stopped there, I think they would be fine. However, they kept going and they said, a reasonable customer, of course, is going to understand when you're buying something online, you're only getting a license. To which the internet said, really?
Well, a reasonable company wouldn't try and bait and switch you when you've given them your hard-earned dollar. Also, would they? So, screw you, Sony, again.
Well, and the other thing is, that same argument, because they try to make the argument of, well, if it worked that way, customer one buys, you know, the digital good. Customer two couldn't possibly buy the same good because the customer one already bought it. I'm like, that same logic applies to physical discs. Like, if customer one bought the physical disc and there was only one copy, then yeah, I couldn't get... No, I'll just buy a second disc. You make multiple discs.
So is a physical disc just a license?
Yes. Legally, yes. Legally, yes. Mm-hmm. When you are buying it, basically you insert it in whatever your player, you are saying, I have a license. My disc is my license to that product.
If owning... What's the phrase?
If buying isn't owning, piracy isn't stealing.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Mm. But this all came from like Windows 95 and stuff, right?
What do you mean?
Like that's where this all started. Tell me. Because you didn't buy the OS. Microsoft was clever and said, you're buying a license to use our operating system. And so that's what caused all of this, I should think, right?
The same true of every iPhone and every MacBook and every...
Yeah, but that all came after, right? Sense. When I guess Mac has started giving away their OS as long as you bought their machine. But I suppose if you looked in the fine print, you probably don't own that OS either. You probably just have a license that came with the machine.
More than likely.
But before, like, mainstream Windows, I'm pretty sure you were actually buying copies of, like, those old games. I don't think that it was just a license to use it.
No, but I mean, I'm saying that legally the idea is the same. Like that's kind of...
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yeah, and I'm agreeing with you 100%. I'm just saying, I think, well, let's just all blame Bill Gates.
So a couple of weeks ago, just 10 minutes from my house, I got the chance to go and listen to Lewis Rossman, you know, the angriest man on the internet, talk about owning your own stuff. It's not the word he uses, but Steve from Gamers Nexus was there. Wendell was there. It was good to hang out with those guys as well. But essentially, this stuff, it just grinds my gears. Like the whole flock camera stuff, I know it's not really related, but it's in that same like digital privacy realm of things that shouldn't be happening. It's not what the internet was invented for. It wasn't to like the enrichment of corporations. It was supposed to be for the betterment of humanity. And it's one of the reasons I think self-hosting is so important, honestly. Because by me having a file on my server, how I got it is not a relevant thing to talk about right now. But the if the file is there, it's mine forever. And they ain't going to revoke a license. I mean, if the hard drive fails, fine, whatever, different story. But the transaction should be an absolute thing that happens. Like, it should be like going to the store and buying a chocolate bar. Like, I buy my disc, I consume my candy, and it's done. I consume my movie, whatever, game, video game, whatever. It's not like I can re-consume a chocolate bar. So it was a bad example, but you know, like, maybe you get my point. Like, I'm not buying I don't think of anything else in my life as buying a license. I'm buying a thing. So why on earth do you get to set this mythical version of the rules that only benefits one side of this equation?
Can I give you the legal reason?
As a consumer, I'm going to vote with my feet and put both my fingers in the air and tell you where to go, you know?
I know, but there's unfortunately a legal reason why.
Oh, come on then, Mr. Lawyer. Tell me why.
Because with a disc, you only have one disc. With a digital copy, you could make a billion copies. So that's the unfortunate reality. If we could find some way of... not DRM, but something like DRM that would actually, you know, prevent infinite copies of things, then I think we would be...
Does it matter?
Legally, people, yes.
Well, the people paying for a Blu-ray disc, what percentage of those... I'd love to know some genuine, like, studies. Are they more likely to pirate or less likely?
So
it doesn't count as a lost sale, certainly.
So actually, the Cord Killers podcast, which is Brian Brushwood and Tom Merritt, they have this phrase that I really like. It's the convenience trumps fidelity. And the idea basically being of streaming one, because streaming was a hell of a lot more convenient than buying a Blu-ray disc. And I think the same is kind of true in the digital world. Yes, I understand. I don't necessarily like the idea of Sony taking things away, which is actually why I like the way Valve does it, where if Valve stops selling something because, you know, either its license expired, the company no longer can make the game, whatever, it gets delisted from the store, so you can't buy it anymore. But if you had a copy, you can still download and play it. I wish companies would do that with their licensing, where they say, okay, we're getting a license to sell this product for, you know, X number of years. But if this license still expires, whoever bought it still has the right to, you know, stream it from us, or has the right to move it to whatever new service is going to have it. If we had that, I think a lot of the problems would go away. And maybe the solution is, we got to have legislation that dictates that, because I don't know if the corporations are going to do it. I mean, Valve clearly did, but Valve seems to be off on an island.
That's just it. If Valve can do it, it shows it's possible.
Now, to be fair, I've been off consoles for a very long time because I just, in my mind, I'm like, wait, how am I going to make this make sense to spend all this money on a thing that just plays games? On the flip side of that, I'm like, ooh, I could buy this very expensive computer that can play games, but it can also do this other thing. So therefore, it makes sense and I can go to sleep at night.
But the trouble with the Steam Machine is it sits in this weird middle ground. Like, it's not good enough to be a genuine gaming behemoth, and it's only a little bit better than the Steam Deck. So it kind of sits in the middle between like a gaming machine and a portable, in this kind of weird, like, it's not even as good as a PS5 Pro, so I'm told.
Again, I think the idea is convenience trumps fidelity. Valve making it so that way it is seamless with HDMI, CEC, and all the other stuff that they have done to make it be, you sit down, you push a button, and you can play. Yes, you could hook up an HTPC, but you're going to have to, you know, figure out some button to turn it on and to get to the right input and all the other stuff. Valve making it easy is worth a little bit to me of a, you know, convenience tax.
Yeah, but it's $1,200 bucks.
That's
entry.
Thank you, Ramageddon, for that one. I think that's the real.
No, that's not their fault.
Their fault, right? Yeah.
No, but as a consumer, like, my pockets are only so deep, you know.
Yeah, but you can support them just through their normal store. You have a nice PC already.
Got quite the pile of shame. And then what do I choose to load up of an evening? OpenTTD.
Factorio.
Factorio, yeah. Always the same three games.
I mean, I just think this is sad because it's just another kind of like nail in the coffin for where everything is going. And it's not unique to Sony. It's not unique to any one specific player. Vote with your dollars. Support things that allow you to download said software if they're going to kill it, like Jeff was saying. One of the things that I wish, and I do think it's going to have to be legislation ultimately if there's going to be something that's more ubiquitous, but another aspect is also for all the games that have server components. The vast majority are not like open sourcing the server components so that you can continue to play that. And it's just such a shame. There's some really wonderful things, you know, and I think a lot of people look at games as art, and the Software Conservatory that's out there is I think trying to push for these sorts of things, and hopefully it gets some more like financial backing in that as well. But so I don't know what the solution is ultimately.
There's the Don't Kill Games movement thing, right? Is that what you're talking about?
I think movement, but I think it's the same idea. I think they're two different efforts, but they're doing the same thing.
Do you really think that every game that is just basically an online game, when it kind of goes end of life, the company should be held responsible to open source or make the server available?
I think so. If you bought the game, why not?
I mean, the game was always online. Mm-hmm. And they were very upfront with, it's an online game. Servers go away like they do. I think maybe there should be a default amount of time that they have to maintain them, unless they are going to opt to make it available to whomever.
There is a default amount of time it's left available, and it's governed by capitalism.
But Sure. But like if they said 10 years, 10 years is the standard and you knew that going in, you couldn't complain when it goes
away. What happens when the next Rampocalypse comes and their server costs triple in that 10-year time? I'm just playing devil's advocate. I agree with you, to be clear, but it's not really a feasible thing, I don't think. What should be more feasible is that there should be some kind of like an end-of-lifing situation, not only for game servers and what have you, but also for physical devices. Like, you just got to stop this e-waste nonsense of like making trash that's basically dead within 6 months because some cloud service disappeared.
But for the server, I'm not talking about, you don't have to open source the entirety of your game, fine. Just the server component, and maybe it's not even open source, but make it freely available so that people can host it themselves. The open source part would be really nice because then you could update and patch things and whatnot, which would be really, really nice.
I did come across a new open source version of Theme Hospital last night.
I'm sorry, what?
An open source version of Theme Hospital.
Never heard of this.
Yeah, no, I definitely did hear what you said. I just don't think I'm called, picturing the same thing that you are talking about.
It's called Core6TH. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Basically, my wife is annoyed with Sega because they have abandoned Two Point Hospital, one of her favorite games, which is basically a modern-day remake of Theme Hospital. Wonderful engine, wonderful mechanics, all the rest of it. And they've just left it. And so she was like, I just want more scenarios, more things to do. And then I saw a YouTube video about this thing, Core6TH. It looks great. I haven't played it yet, but looks good.
I was expecting a lot more things with, like, pleather and stuff. Okay, this is a very different thing. Looks like a fun little game.
Wow.
I mean, okay. I want to see...
And with that, we're going to wrap up the episode. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. We appreciate you very much. If you want to get in touch with us, remember, contact@bitflip.show. Until next time, I've been Alex.
I've been Adam.
I've been Jeff.
And I've been Stephen.
Au revoir. Lovely. What the f*** was that ending, Stephen?
Are you kidding? You said Theme Hospital, and I'm like...
Yeah, it was a little strange.
Sorry, what?
It was a little strange.
You know who your co-host is.
We have to stay warm in the winters up here, man.
You gotta be careful with Steven.
Am I just missing something? Theme Hospital is just a game.
Never heard of it. I have never heard of it in my life.
No, not either.
No, I'm serious. I've never heard of this in my life. I had to look it up.
Is this like Oregon Trail for like the British? Is that kind of what it is?
What?
No, for real.
You played Theme Park, right?
I played like Dino Park Tycoon.
For the British.
Oh my god! You guys, you've heard of Transport Tycoon, right?
Yeah, yeah, I've heard of that. Exactly. Yeah, yes, we've heard of that.
Its ugly stepsister was Theme Park, and the engine they used for that was developed for Theme Hospital, which, as you can imagine, is a way of building a hospital. And the patients that come in have really stupid diseases like frying pan on headitis and. you know, really, really stupid stuff. I hope we're all still recording, by the way.
We are. Oh, this is going to be a lot of fun.
I can't believe you've never heard of Theme Hospital. My dudes. Here's my gift to you this evening. Go play this for 20 minutes. You'll have fun. It's a really great game.
It's $2.99 on GOG.com.
Worth it. I will buy it for you.
Interesting. I'm looking at this now. Okay.
I was expecting something that you would type into like a hub website.
No. My God, okay. You guys. What are you
okay, so,
about?
So this
Theme
so the,
Hospital?
The,
like...
this looks like Dino Park Tycoon to me. I can see the... Okay, interesting. Yeah, never saw this at all.
I really want to see Steven's Steam library now.
Okay, in fairness, if you go to the GOG.com website and search for Theme Hospital, the image, the logo box art looking thing on the site,
it's like a...
does lend itself to a female nurse touching a doctor.
And a dog looking doctor too, which is...
Granted, but...
Yes.
I was 9 years old when this game came out. Such thoughts hadn't been invented, right? The internet was still a pure place in 1997, I think.
No, it wasn't. You were playing. You were playing Duke 3D, and you were going up to the strip club, and you're like, "Shake it, baby!" That was happening.
I was playing a lot of Transport Tycoon at that age. Honestly, to be Transport Tycoon Deluxe.
I was a StarCraft.
We had very different.
I actually think Roller Coaster Tycoon was 1997 as well.
It looks that same genre, the same art style, like not 99. Art style, but yeah.
Good lord, I was late.
How old were you? I'm sorry?
99? 99, I was
11. Oh, God, I hate you guys.
There was a new Roller Coaster Tycoon announced this week. Did you see this? Wonderworks? No. It looks like shit, but it's using the same franchise, so.
Interesting. I don't know. What caught my eye is I kind of want to buy the new 007 game. Apparently, it's on sale right now on Steam. And I'm like, I told myself I was not going to buy more games, but damn it, it looks good.
It does.
The world is opening up beneath our feet. I tell you what, like all of these open source clones and things, like over the years, I have played the snot out of OpenTTD, but I've always wished it could do a few things like copy and paste. And I told my agent last night, I wish it had copy and paste. And an hour later, it did. And it's like, oh my God, this is it. This is so cool. I hate it, but I also love it.
I don't.
Do you know what I mean?
I don't know what to play on this. I've just been making emulators work.
I could write you a little tiny violin app and you could play that.
I'm not.
I'll buy it off you. Send it to me.
Yeah, I'll pay him a penny more.
A penny more. No, but like... I want to play things on here out of the Steam library, but like I think I really mainly bought this because I wanted to get rid of the Apple TV and whatnot and the Switch 2 that I have, and I wanted to give the middle finger to Nintendo because I hate them now.
Good. They deserve it just reasons, as much as Sony do.
For the exact reasons that we were discussing. And so that's why I bought this, because it is a fantastic emulation machine.
Yeah.
All right. I'm like, gonna buy one.
Like that's why I bought it, strictly for the emulation. But I actually don't know what I would want to play in my Steam library, because everything uses a mouse and a keyboard that I would care to play on there.
Mm. The touchpads are actually pretty good for, like, I've been playing Satisfactory, which was designed as a, mouse and keyboard game, and it's not bad.
Yeah, I like them, and I think they're genuinely great. Like, no other console is doing these fun little pad things, right? And then you can feel when it's actually tracking, and that's lovely. But I'm just not playing something like StarCraft.
Oh, fair.
With those pads.
Fair. Yeah.
Like, I'm just not doing it.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
Because you have to be quick, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
If I was playing maybe like a Sim City or something like that, I suppose I could just like, oh, I overshot that building. I can just come back a little bit, and that's fine. But I don't know.
We gotta spin up some Deep Rock Galactic. We should have our own little bit flip team.
Have you made it do the Wilhelm scream?
Yes.
That's the best thing about this
controller.
Once
you learn about the Wilhelm scream, you hear it everywhere, don't you?
Yes, I hear it about as much as your microphone getting loud again.
Well, he just got too close. He got too close to a gentleman.
Maybe you think so? I don't know. No, yeah, that's not bad.
I think he did.
I have PTSD from it now.
Yeah, well, I was playing Hell Out of Satisfactory before I, started drywalling my basement and, had to take my OLED down so that we didn't get covered in, drywall dust, which got freaking everywhere. So as soon as I get everything painted and carpeted, which will hopefully be in the next month or so, I can get back to playing, because I would really like to start playing games again.
Where do you play? On your couch upstairs? We've probably asked this before, but
so right now I'm sitting at my gaming PC technically.
Okay.
But I don't actually play down here. I usually been playing on my Steam machine, or I play on my upstairs station at my office. But I'm trying to get myself to play more in the basement on the TV, just because it's such a nice again, I have my Steam controller hooked up there. I have a nice big TV, a comfy couch, kind of doing a little bit of Alex was saying like episode or two ago, where it's like the separation of work and, home, trying to do that a little bit. Which, by the way, I really actually enjoyed the work from home thing, by the way. That was an interesting discussion.
Mm-hmm. Have any of you on this applies to the Steam Deck as well. Have any of you just been able to get like Plex to just install and work? Or do you like have to do this weird thing where you go into the desktop mode, install it as a app image or like a flat pack, and then apply it so that it shows up in the game mode, and then it doesn't pick up the controller anyway, and I can't use Plex because this doesn't work in Plex, and I can't figure out the stupid setting to make that work.
Welcome to...
Is that a thing?
Welcome to Linux.
Okay.
Welcome to Linux.
I get that, but like they're so close to just destroying anything like an Apple TV or like, you know, the Android boxes. Like if that just worked as well as an Android box or whatever to just install the app for Plex and whatnot, and my child could just walk up and press the same buttons and it would just bloody well work, this would be the best set-top box ever.
How are you installing it? You said desktop mode, but
you have
more
to go
detail.
Into the desktop mode, and then you have to install a flat pack.
Yep.
Which is okay. Which is like the Plex thing, and then you tell it show this up in the game mode.
Yep.
And then it shows up as what would look like a game kind of icon mm-hmm. thing, but it's at the far right, which is bloody annoying. But it doesn't have the nice icon for some god fucked reason.
Yep. Fix that.
Yeah, well, of course you do.
There might be an alt path is what I was thinking, because there was a bunch of hoops you used to have to jump through, and it's not like the easiest thing to do, but Game Pass, Microsoft Game Pass, you could actually play on Steam previously, and it was via like a flat pack of Edge that you get on the Steam Deck.
Same idea.
Shortcut. Okay. Yeah. But it might work better? I don't know.
Yeah, I just think that stuff like that, because they're producing a box and they're producing a handheld, if they just had those apps on their store, the world would be wonderful.
That's actually not a terrible idea. It'd be nice to have like Moonlight easily installed as well. Or
yeah, Alex, are you hearing this? Are you paying attention to this conversation? Okay,
we couldn't possibly comment though, right?
You had a deck, sold, bought again.
I've made my deck over the years. Thank you.
I had the deck. I actually didn't sell it. I gave it to my nephew. Huh. But because I never used, man, I buy these things and then I'm like, okay, I'm going to load all kinds of different distributions on it and use it as a computer.
Never I had the smoked
the damn
one.
Thing is, oh, did you?
The deck's just a bit
I
too
did,
big.
I did, yeah, and I sold that.
For carrying. You know, like this must last be nice. 2 weeks would have been a perfect time to take a Steam Deck with me. I was on a flight for 5 hours. I was in a hotel room for hours on end. What?
Nothing.
Your deck is too big. I said it must be nice.
For carrying specifically.
Yeah, for carrying, it's a monster, right? Like it's really hard to carry.
Oh God.
Well, I hope the patrons are enjoying this shit show of a post show.
Man,
this is fantastic.
If you leave the door that wide open, what do you think's going to happen? I'm sorry.
I expect someone with consummate professionals who can keep their in their pants, but apparently not.
Oh no,
not
after hours on a Friday, bro.
No, man, this is no.
Well, anyway, back to my point. It's just a bit too big to fit into a backpack comfortably.
Yeah, okay? It is. I absolutely prefer to hold like the Switch.
Yeah,
and I understand that I don't get these little pads and whatnot on a Switch, but like, it's just smaller. I can put it in a bag and I can take it away, and I don't pull it out and it feels like this like ancient tablet from Egypt that actually has hieroglyphs on it. And there's actually a what's that tablet called? Oh bloody hell! What's the one that they use to be able to tell, like, translate all of that language?
The Rosetta Stone.
Rosetta Stone. Yeah, so it's not like I'm pulling the Rosetta Stone out of my, you know, LTT backup or backpack.
Yeah. I don't know. I like the idea of the deck. What I'm kind of looking for, like, I think Acer is coming out with, like, a... You guys remember the Logitech Hub? Not the Logitech Hub. It was like the Logitech thing you basically could stream games to. It was basically a streaming thing. Acer's coming out with their own version of that supposedly runs Linux and supposedly will work with Moonlight and Sunshine.
Way better plan. I would go with that, depending
on pricing, that could be compelling for me.
I completely agree. I think you just need to understand who you are and the realities of it. Like, are you really somebody who's going to leave the house all the time and use this thing? Or do you just want the convenience to go up in your bed and play once in a while? So a cheap, nice screen with a nice controller attached to it, like what you were just saying, Jeff, I think that's something that I would actually get behind.
So do you remember the commute that we had to do to take, Adam, to take you down to the Tailscale event? Yes. And so a lot of people do that commute from my town to Toronto every single day of their life, but they have the option to take a train. Mm. Yeah, I know, Alex, I wouldn't do it either. It's asinine. But I always imagined that if I was sitting in a train, because it's a technically it's a longer commute because they stop at each place. But if I had to do that because it's far safer and less stress, something like the Steam Deck would be perfectly fine, right? Because like I'm sitting there for like 2 hours every single day there and then 2 hours back. And then it makes sense. But yeah, I don't know. It is too large for what I was using it for. I felt like a bit of a tool anytime I'd pull it out.
I used to do that, Stephen. I used to do that once a week going from Norwich to London, 2 hours each way.
Yep.
I hated it.
But that's like once a week and
it's still enough though, I tell you.
I mean,
I used to go. And then sometimes I'd spend the night because I'm like, this is just, I'm not coming all this way. Yeah.
No.
I was very glad.
Have you guys seen,
to move to London?
Have you seen these little Android, they're literally just made for ripping off Game Boy Advances and stuff like this. But they're just little Android things that look like a kind of like a mini version of the Switch.
Like the Ambaric stuff?
The emulator. It's the emulator stuff that's coming straight out of China, but like doesn't suck. And so you spend like $150 and you get like a nice screen and Android experience and all of the emulators built into it already.
Isn't one called the Odin, I think?
That's the Ion Neo.
So many
Odin. It's Raven.
Yeah, Ion Neo has one that caught my eye. I have a little, again, self-hosted. I think, I remember if it was you, Alex, or if it was Chris, had the RG36S.
Oh, the R36S. Yes, that was
I still have mine. I played Pokemon on it. That was a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah, and the screen on that thing, it was way better than it had any right to be for that price.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, great little thing. Like, Ella loves it. She can't quite operate it yet, but she's getting there. You know, like, give it maybe another year and she'll have it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've yet to introduce my son to Pokemon. He keeps asking for a Switch 2, and I'm like, not doing it. Not doing it.
Yeah, because, okay. It was the end of the road for my Switch when I wanted to buy Advanced Wars, whatever the version for Switch 2 that just came out, which is really just the classic Nintendo thing. We're just going to remake the games we've always done. And so it's like releasing the first version and the second version of Advanced Wars. And it's literally just like this little pixelated game that's kind of like a role-based thing, kind of like Risk, I suppose. But they want, in Canadian funds, like $100 for this. It's a Game Boy game with slightly better graphics, but it's a Game Boy game they've released a million times. $100.
What?
I can't. Because something on Steam that's equally of quality is like $40 when it came out brand new, like just fresh release. And I'd be okay with like $40, but $100. I guess the cartridge is made of unobtainium.
Gold.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, I don't know. But anyway.
It must be Pokemon Platinum Edition or something.
Oh, that'd be something. No, absolutely. You know, lining Nintendo's pocketbooks. Wow.